Welcome, everyone, to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is IBM HTTP Server Performance Tuning. Our presenters are Naveen Chidi and Marvin Knight. Naveen works for WebSphere Level 2 Support Team. He supports WebSphere Community Edition, WebSphere Edge, IBM HTTP Server, WebSphere Plugin, and WebSphere Java Proxy Components. Marvin has been with IBM for 32 years. He is currently an advisory software engineer supporting the IBM HTTP Server, HTTP Plugin, and Edge Components. Prior to that, he worked in ISPS development and support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Naveen.
Thank you, Kathy. Good morning, good day, good evening, depending upon wherever you all have joined in from. Welcome to this WebSphere Technical Exchange. Kathy, can we move to the next slide, please? So today's agenda, we have divided into two parts. We have tried to pack in a lot of information in this 45 to 50 minutes in which we are expected to complete it. So pardon us if we sound as if we are rushing through the slides. Some of the tuning considerations we are going to handle today is, some out-of-the-box tuning concerns, some configuration features to avoid. Performance tuning, I would call performance tuning or compare it to the economy. There's so many handles. Changing certain parameters has implications elsewhere. So we'll try to discuss some of them. SSL plays a huge role as far as impact and performance. We'll discuss some of that. And then there's network and OS related tuning considerations, which impact tuning performance. And the last part is the tuning considerations on the plugin, which my colleague Marvin will handle. Going to slide 3, please. So what are some of the out-of-box IHS tuning concerns? So henceforth, I will refer to IBM HTTP Server as IHS or just the web server, so that's not a mouthful. The first tuning decision you'll need to make is determining how many simultaneous connections your IBM HTTP Server or IHS installation will need to support. Many other tuning decisions are dependent on this value, and coming slides discusses the topic in more detail. The default SSL cipher spec ordering enables maximum strength SSL connections at significant performance penalty, and I'll be talking about it in a bit more detail in later charts. So with IHS 2.0 and above, send file usage is disabled in the default configuration file. This avoids some occasional platform-specific problems, but it also has the potential of increasing CPU utilization. So on AIX specifically, if you must enable send file, then one needs to set the NBC limit to a much more conservative value. NBC stands for Network Buffer Cache. A value of 256 megabits is what is recommended. The default AIX setting for NBC limit is 768 megabits. So a higher value for NBC limit and the web server use of send file results in a large amount of memory utilization due to the network buffer cache. IHS provides support for send file on Solaris X84, but not on Solaris Spark platforms. It has been observed that send file is slower than normal file handling on Solaris Spark. In AIX, setting the malloc multi-heap with the set number of heaps enables a memory management scheme for AIX heap library, which is better for multi-threaded applications and configures it to try to minimize memory use and to use a moderate number of heaps. for configurations with extensive heap operations, SSL or certain third-party modules in the picture, CPU utilization can be lowered by changing the setting to malloc multi-heap equals true. Although this setting may increase the memory usage slightly. So we have the concept of Fast Response Cache Accelerator, FRCA. It's a kernel-resident micro HTTP server, which is optimized for serving static, non-access protected files directly out of the file system. The use of FRCA can dramatically reduce CPU utilization in some configurations. FRCA cannot be used for serving content over HTTPS or encrypted SSL connections. FRCA is disabled by default, as some extensions like Norton's antivirus are not compatible with it. Can we move to slide 4, please, Kathy? So the next couple of slides discusses how to go about determining maximum connections. So max connections needs to be figured out based on the load on the busiest part of the day. A value of 125% of the peak load is considered a safe limit for max connections. So at any given moment, a single user can require anywhere from 0 to 4 independent TCP connections. IBM HTTP server on Windows has a parent process and a single multi-threaded child process. It should be noted that IHS on Windows is a 32-bit application even when running on a 64-bit Windows operating system. Threads for child is the maximum number of simultaneous connections within memory considerations, of course, and constraints. The value of thread limit affects the size of the shared memory segment the server uses to perform inter-process communication between the parent and the single child process. Do not increase thread limit beyond what is required for threads per child. These numbers are not exact limits because the real limits are the sum of the fixed startup costs of memory for each thread, plus the maximum runtime memory usage per thread, which varies based on configuration and workload. Raising threads per child and approaching these limits risk child process crashes when runtime memory usage puts the process address space over 2 gigabytes or 3 gigabyte barrier. The upper limits become even more restrictive when loading other modules such as mod memcache or when there are many rewrite maps or rewrite conditions and rewrite rule directives. Slide 5, please, Kathy. So continuing with determining max connections, IHS on Unix OS has a single-threaded parent process which starts and maintains one or more multi-threaded child processes. Server limit is a built-in upper limit on the number of child processes. At runtime, the actual upper limit on the number of child processes is max clients divided by the threads per child. Threads per child directive is to control how many threads each child process starts. The value of thread limit affects the size of the shared memory segment the server uses to perform inter-process communication between the parent and the child process. So the rule of thumb would be do not increase the thread limit beyond what is required for threads per child. So the max clients directive places an upper limit on the number of simultaneous connections the server can handle. Max clients should be set according to the expected load. The max spare threads and minimum spare thread directives or min spare threads directive affects how the server reacts to changes in the server load. Since IHS checks this value approximately once per second, min spare threads should safely exceed the number of new requests you might receive in any second or per second. Setting the min spare threads too high with the WebSphere plugin may trigger premature spawning of new child processes. Each additional process results in a dedicated web container thread being consumed. Setting min spare threads too low may induce delays of a few seconds if IHS runs out of processing threads. Usually, one should set max pair threads to 25 to 30% of the max client value. If it is too small a fraction of the max clients, child processes will be terminated and recreated frequently, thus increasing CPU usage. Increasing threads per child and also thread limit will reduce the number of total server processes needed, reducing the per-server memory overhead. However, there are a number of possible drawbacks to increasing the threads per child. Setting and max memory, to example 512, will limit memory retained by each thread. Going to slide 6, please. So this is the last of the slides which helps in determining max connections. The typical way to determine the max connection number of simultaneous connection is to monitor the status using mod_status, which can be enabled in your HTTPD.conf file during the day until typical behavior is understood, or you can map the behavior of the load factor throughout the day. You can also use mod_npmstats to come to the same conclusion. Both tools give outputs in different formats. Mod_npmstats also has a configurable scan interval, which mod_stats, you have to unless you use a script, you have to manually send a request to figure out what the current load is. Mod_npmstats has a configurable scan interval, so you don't have to monitor it. It writes these outputs into the IHS error log. You can also use the netset command to determine the TCP connection between the client and the IHS. Like I told earlier, each process can consume up to four TCP connections. Each request, I'm sorry. Going to slide 7. So, like I said earlier, I hope I'm not going too fast. The only reason being we are trying to cram a lot of information in 45 minutes, and each topic, the IHS side of tuning and the plugin side of tuning, deserves more than an hour on its own. So going to slide 7, there are certain configuration features which one needs to avoid if your environment really does not need them. So one of them is hostname lookups. This directive enables DNS lookups so that hostnames can be logged in the remote_host header. So the default is off in order to save network traffic for those sites that don't truly need the reverse lookups done. It is also better for end users because they don't have to suffer the extra latency that a lookup entails. Heavily loaded sites should leave this directive off, since DNS lookups can take considerable amount of time. And, of course, this is a performance penalty. Identity check directive enables logging of the remote username for each connection, and it can cause serious latency problems accessing your server, since every request requires one of these lookups to be performed. When firewalls are involved, each lookup might possibly fail and add 30 seconds of latency to each hit. So in general, this is not a very useful, on publicly accessible servers on the Internet. Mod_mime_magic module determines the MIME type of files which are requested in your request. So this module is active only if magic file directive is specified by the MIME magic file directive. Performance penalty is extra CPU and disk I/O to try to find the file MIME type. Content digest directive enables the generation of content MD5 headers as defined in RFC 1864 and RFC 2068 respectively. So the content MD5 header provides an end-to-end message integrity check, also known as MIC, of the entity body. Since the message digest is computed on every request and the values are not cached, it can cause considerable overhead. Max request per child can use extra CPU to terminate and create child processes. With IHS 2 and 2.0 and higher, on Linux and Unix, this can lead to an excessive number of child processes, which in turn can lead to excessive swap space usage. Once a child process reaches max requests for child, it will not handle any new connections, but existing connections are allowed to complete. In other words, only one long-running request in the process will keep the process active, sometimes indefinitely. In environments where long-running requests are not unusual, a large number of existing child processes can build up. In recent releases of IHS, that is IHS 8.0 and higher, this is set to an optimal setting of zero in the default configuration file. So the .htaccess access file provides a way to make configuration changes on a per directory basis. This obviously needs a directory access, an extra CPU and disk I/O to locate the .htaccess files in the directories where the static files are served from. Detailed logging, for example, SSH trace plugin with log levels set to trace, Gskit trace, a third-party module to logging, we often enable them during problem diagnosis. Sometimes we forget to disable them, and that can cause excessive CPU utilization than in normal and cause can be the cause of performance issues. So all the directives I discussed up till now, they are disabled by default in the sample http.conf file which is provided during install. The one which is enabled is the follow symlinks. If the static files are maintained by untrusted users, you may want to disable this option in the configuration file in order to prevent those untrusted users from creating symlinks to private files that should not ordinarily be served. By disabling follow symlinks to prevent this problem will result in performance degradation since the web server then has to check every component of the path name to determine if the file, if it is a symbolic link. Going to slide 8, please. So as I said, performance tuning, any performance tuning can be equated to economy. There are many handles, and changing one parameter can cause, trickle effects elsewhere. And one has to consider carefully what the effects or implications are of making certain changes. So there are advantages and disadvantages for different values of threads per child. Higher values for threads per child result in lower overall memory use of the server. As long as the value of the threads per child isn't higher than the normal number of concurrent TCP connections handled by the server. Extremely high values for threads per child may result in encountering address space limitations on the OS level. Higher values for threads per child often results in lower number of connections, which the WebSphere connection maintains the application server, and better sharing of the markdown information. Higher values for threads per child result in higher CPU utilization for SSL-specific processing. In older Linux distributions such as Red Hat, Advanced Server 2.1, or SUSE/8, which use Linux threads library, higher values for threads per child result in higher CPU utilization in the threads library. So some features in IHS may also aggravate this problem, such as rewrite mapping or modules such as mod_mem_cache or some LDAP, IBM LDAP modules or any LDAP modules or the third-party LDAP modules, or mod_extension_filter. So higher threads per child result in a more effective use of the cache and connection pooling in mod_IBM_LDAP. Higher threads per child result in a more effective use of cache in mod_mem_cache because each child must fill its own cache. Max pair threads equals max clients is also beneficial for mod_mem_cache because it prevents child processes who have built up large caches from being gracefully terminated. System tuning may be necessary to run with higher values for threads per child if IBM HTTP server fails to start after increasing threads per child. check the error log for any error messages. A common failure is a failed attempt to create worker thread. It usually starts with APR underscore thread underscore create, and it says unable to create worker thread error. So going to slide 9, please. So continuation of the implications of configuration changes vis-a-vis performance. Max client parameter is also used for tuning the web server to handle a greater client load. When max client is increased, the value for max pair threads should be scaled up as well. Otherwise, extra CPU will be spent terminating and creating child processes when the load changes by even a relatively small amount. This directive controls whether some important information is saved in the scoreboard for use by mod underscore stats. When this is set to on, web server CPU usage may increase by as much as 1%. However, it can make mod underscore stats reports more informative and useful. I was talking about the extended stats option for our mod underscore stats. So going to slide 10, please. So SSL plays a huge part in performance, in a WebSphere or IHS web server and plugin WebSphere plugin environment. Any request which comes in, if it comes in as an HTTPS, has additional overheads, and we'll talk about that in the following few slides. So when an SSL connection is established, the client, typically a web browser, and the web server negotiate the cipher to use for a connection. So the web server has an ordered list of ciphers, and the first cipher in that list, which is supported by the client, will be selected. So by default, the IBM HTTP server prefers AES and RC4 ciphers over computationally expensive triple desk cipher suit. And tuning of the order or the list in which the SSL cipher appear in the HTTPD.conf file, affects the performance usually because the selection is based on that. Going to slide 11, please. So this, we have an example out here, which directs the server to prefer strong 128-bit RC4 cipher first, and will provide a significant performance improvement over the default configuration. So this sample out here, configuration sample, does not support weaker 40-bit or 56-bit or null plain text ciphers that security scanners may complain about. This was from the days of old. So the example here depicts orders them in a way that will cause IHS to prefer the less expensive, less CPU-intensive ciphers. SSL, you'll see that SSL v2 is disabled implicitly by not including any SSL v2 ciphers. Going to slide 12, please. So in IHS version 8 and higher, or later, new ciphers and new syntax for SSL cipher spec are supported. So this is a required change since new TLS protocols with a disjoint set of ciphers are supported. You'll see in the example, you'll see the disjoint set of ciphers included in there. So these same releases of IHS also favor strong ciphers, but also completely disable weak and export ciphers. So you'll see the example out there with weaker but less expensive CPU-intensive ciphers. So going to slide 13. Here the example shows how to format the logging of SSL related logs, how to capture certain key information for an SSL request. For every request, SSL cipher negotiated for each connection, there are certain values which need to be captured. So the log format will produce an output to the SSL cipher.log that lists the cipher selected, the key size, and amongst other variables. So, of course, enabling this enhanced logging has its own overhead on each SSL request. Going to slide 14, please. So the size of the SSL certificate does play a significant part in the performance of an SSL request. Larger server certificates are also costly. Every doubling of key size costs 4 to 8 times more CPU for the required computation. Unfortunately, with faster faster CPUs powers and rising industry standard to handle more creative intrusion attacks, certificate sizes currently are at 2048 and higher. That's the bit size of the certificates. When a new session is created, the primary cost in terms of computation is associated, at the front end, which is the SSL handshake part of it. Using SSL sessions and using Keep Alive can make a significant difference in alleviating performance concerns due to SSL enablement. Slide 15, please, Kathy. So the SSL CPU utilization will be lower with low values of threads per child. For a server with high SSL traffic, an optimum threads per child of 100 is recommended. This ensures client load is spread among multiple child processes. This optimization is not possible on Windows, which only supports a single child process. So, setting malloc multi-heap to true when there is a significant SSL traffic results in better performance for heap operations used by SSL operations. Installation and maintenance of crypto cards can be complex, and in many situations we have observed using crypto cards where the improvement is less than 10%, and it's for clients to make a decision whether they need the additional hassles of managing crypto cards. The generation of shared key is a very expensive, CPU-intensive aspect. In order to avoid generating the shared key for every TCP connection, there is a capability to reuse the same SSL session for multiple connections. The client must request to reuse the same SSL session in the subsequent handshake, and the server must have the SSL session identifier cached. The use of load balances between web clients and web server presents a special problem. By that I mean the IBM HTTP server cannot share a session ID cache across machines. Use of a load balancer in front of the web server is to spread load across multiple web servers. So thus, the SSL session can be reused only if a subsequent TCP connection from the same client is sent by the load balancer to the same web server. So if it goes to another web server, the session cannot be reused, and the shared key must be regenerated at a greater CPU expense. When SSL is being used and excessive web server CPU utilization is noticed, it is important to first confirm that session affinity is enabled if a load balancer is being used. Going to slide 16, please. So in previous slides, I tried to address as best as I could to the main issues which need to where we need to pay attention in terms of IHS performance tuning. There are other areas which affect performance and need some consideration. So low data transfer rates is seen when handling large post requests due to small TCP receive buffer size being used for the web server sockets. This results in client being limited in how much data it can send before the server machine has to acknowledge it, resulting in poor network utilization. Increasing receive buffer size is a solution to address this concern. In AIX 5 X shows unexpected network latency during large post data transfers and can be corrected by setting AIX network tuning options. So the OS tuning is a whole topic. I'm not going to go into it at all because that's a whole different beast on its own. So the link I provided gives you all the information which you might need. So IBM HTTP Server or IHS will query the resolver library for IP4 and IPv6 addresses for the host. This can result in extra DNS queries on AIX, even when IPv4 address is defined in HTTP host. To work around this issue, IPv6 lookups can be disabled. Web server activity related to file access and send file functions were found to be contributing to high write I.O. Changing send file API to enable AIX Connect kernel to deliver the file contents to the client from the network buffer cache alleviates this issue to some extent. However, enabling send file functions to utilize network buffer cache may result in large amount of kernel memory to be devoted to caching of static files. This I already addressed in previous slides. So usually send file is disabled by default on AIX IHS combo. So the WebSphere plugin will normally reload the plugin configuration file during steady state operation if the file is modified. The refresh interval determines, keeps a check, see if the plugin CFG.xml is modified. So when reload occurs during steady state operation, it must be reloaded in every web server child process serving request. Initialization of HTTP transport is particularly CPU intensive. So if there are many such transport defined or many child processes, the CPU impact can be very high. Disk writes to access can become a bottleneck at high loads on operation, some of the operating systems. NPM stats output will show many busy threads in log state, indicating that there's a lot of disk I.O. going on. Enabling buffered logs can reduce the disk I.O. rate due to logging and access log. Going to slide 17, please. The use of max connection parameter in WebSphere plugin configuration is most effective when there is a single IHS child process. It is usually more effective to actively prevent backend systems from accepting more connections than they can reliably handle, performing the throttling at the TCP level. When this is done at the client side, there is no cross-system or cross-process coordination, which makes the limits ineffective. Using max connections with more than one child process or across a web server farm introduces a number of complications. Each IHS child process must have a high enough max connections value to allow each thread to be able to find the backend server. But the child process should not be able to overrun an individual application server at any time. Only WebSphere plugin threads in a single IHS child process share info about the app server markdowns. Basically, it does not share app server markdown information across child processes. As the number of child processes increases, that is the ratio of threads per child over max client shrinks. If the ESI invalidation servlet is used with the WebSphere plugin, more and more web container threads will be permanently consumed. With that said, I would like to hand over the presentation to my colleague Marvin, and part of the presentation has more important information from a plug-in tuning perspective. With that, Marv, would you please take over?
Thank you, Naveen. Can we go to slide 18 now? We're going to cover in the next section plug-in performance tips, go over many of the plug-in properties that can be set. We're in no way going to cover every single property. We're going to focus on the ones that deal mainly with performance. We're going to look at SSL, caching, different timers, connections, the impact of multi-processing, load balancing, and then miscellaneous settings. Slide 19, please. A As Naveen mentioned earlier, SSL is probably one of the biggest impacts to performance. The easiest way to avoid this would be to do SSL offloading. There's two ways with the web server and the plugin that you could do SSL offloading. One would be to do it in front of the web server. The other is within the web server and offloads going from the plugin to the app server. If you offload in front of the web server, you're probably going to need a web container property called HTTPS indicator header. This property sets the name of a header that the SSL offloader will then create. So if you have something like an offloader such as F5, it would be responsible for setting a header that you call SSL, whatever name you want to create it. And then the web container property would need to be set specifying the name of that header. That will tell the application server that SSL was actually done so that it knows not to send a 302 redirect back asking for SSL requests. One option that can be done if your SSL offloader does not have the capability of setting the header would be to actually generate the header in the IHS web server. You could use mod headers and a request header set directive to actually create the name of the directive. You might do this if you know all your requests are coming in as SSL, but everything coming into the web server is port 80 and the offloader doesn't have the capability of setting the header itself. Just an easy way to cheat. Slide 20, please. At the web server, you could also generate the SSL offloading. The way you would do this is in the plugin, you would only specify an HTTP transport. When the SSL comes in, the fact that there's no HTTPS transport, the plugin would send the request via HTTP. Another way that can actually cause SSL offloading would be either accidental or intentional. And that would be due to a GSCID error that occurs in the plugin if the plugin has problems with the SSL initialization itself. If you get a password error during SSL initialization in the plugin disables the HTTPS transport. If the personal certificate is expired, it will disable the SSL transport. In both of those cases, you'll have SSL offloading whether you realized it or not. In version 8.5.5, this behavior changes. There's a new property called useUnSecure that must be set to true if you want the plugin to do SSL offloading. What we realize is that you may have cases where the plugin was doing SSL offloading and the client didn't actually want this to occur. So you might have had an audit or some other reasoning behind forcing SSL to the app server, and the plugin actually changed it to do offloading, and this was not the desired behavior. By default, in 8.5.5, you will have to intentionally set a property to get that SSL offloading at the plugin. Slide 21, please. Now, if you actually have SSL going to the application server, as Naveen mentioned earlier, any SSL processing handshakes can be expensive. One thing we see in the plugin and support is a 500 response code coming back to the server. This can occur quite frequently when you're first setting up the plugin to send SSL to the app server. The reason for the 500 is typically a GSCID 414 error that's a bad certificate. The most common reason for that is the plugin KDB is missing the root certificate for the app server. In version 6 and prior, the app servers typically had self-signed certificates, and the way you would avoid that was by having the plugin KDB to have the self-signed certificate, and the plugin KDB is a signer certificate. With version 7 and higher, the app servers typically have a root certificate, and that root certificate is what needs to be in the plugin KDB as a signer. This is probably one of the most common errors we see in setting up SSL to go from the plugin to the app server. Just a word of warning also, the plugin KDB and the IHS KDB are typically two separate entities. You have two separate handshakes that occur. You have the handshake from the client to the web server, and then the handshake from the plugin to the app server. Sometimes clients will combine these KDBs into one file for ease of maintenance. The thing you have to worry about if you do that is if you propagate a KDB from the plugin or from the app server to the plugin, if that KDB does not have the IHS personal certificate, you can end up wiping out that personal certificate. So just be aware of that. Now, assuming a good handshake occurs, the performance implications would be what's the level of security you have specified in the application server. I believe it's the quality of protection screen within the app server under managed certificates where you set the level of security that's used for the app server, whether you're using SSL V2, V3, SSL V1.2, or TLS V1.2. The higher the level of security, the more expensive the handshake will be. An even worse situation would be if you set mutual authentication. Then you have the app server exchanging a certificate and the plugin presenting its certificate. So that increases your performance overhead. Some sites may require that due to audit reasons, because of security, because it's something like a bank where you have to have certain government regulations. For the most part, you can do offloading or you can keep the lower level of security from the plugin to the app server because it's typically behind a firewall. Also, quite frequently, the plugin and the app server are on the same machine, especially if you're in a single app server environment. In that case, having an SSL handshake would seem to be somewhat wasted because you're never leaving the machine. So these are things to keep in mind. Next slide, please, 22. With APARPK 78546, there were some new properties introduced with the plugin. As you can see in the slide, 7003-61023 was where this was introduced. There's a property called SSL Consolidate. This will come in handy where you have multiple clusters or a multi-processing web server with a lot of SSL environments. With the Consolidate property, if you have the same KDB and STH file for each of the clusters, the plugin will not initialize a new GSCID environment every time. So this gives you a little bit of performance gain by having it. We also introduced two new properties that allow you to utilize the PKCS type drivers if you're doing the actual SSL in the machine itself. Slide 23, please. ESI caching. This is the caching that's available within the plugin itself. It works in conjunction with Dynacache on the app server side, so you have the ability to cache not only JPEGs, but JSPs or anything that's been specified in the Dynacast side on the app server. It's enabled by default. You can set it to true or false depending on your preference. The ESI max cache size property is where you can set the size of the cache. 1024K is the default. That can be modified. The thing to remember with this is, as in the web server, it's one cache per process. So if you're dealing with start server set to 20, you may have 20 processes. So you're going to have 20 caches as a result of that. Less processes, less caches, easier to maintain, trade-off between whether you need more processes or not for performance reasons or reliability of the web server. The ESI cache ID full, that's important if you're dealing with multiple clusters where you may have the same application or same URI shared across different clusters. So you might have UAT and production from one web server. They would have the same applications but under different clusters. In that particular case, you would need something like this to distinguish a cache from prod and UAT. You would specify the host name and the URI as the key. The invalidation monitor is a monitor that runs between the app server and the plugin. Utilize thread, and that's a way of invalidating cache. Enable to pass cookies, just a way of being able to disable cookies from being cached. Slide 24, please. Now we'll cover some of the timers. These are the timers we're going to look at, the connect timeout, the server I.O. timeout, server I.O. timeout, retry, the refresh interval, retry interval, and then there were some new timers introduced with APAR 94198 that we'll go over. Slide 25, please. The connect timeout. It does pretty much what it says it does. It's the how long the plugin will wait on the connection to the application server, usually a time of such as 5 or 3 is sufficient. It's really going to depend upon your network as to what time you want to specify for that. The thing to keep in consideration is how many clusters do you have? For instance, 12 members in a cluster. If you've got a timeout of greater than 5 and you've got a number of those clusters or members that are not actually connected at the moment, down for maintenance or some other reason, then you could potentially have the plugin going through looking at each of these down app servers trying to make a connection. So you could potentially run into a situation where with 6 down members, you could have 6 times 5 or 30 seconds of delay waiting to get a connection. So this could be expensive. In a case like this, what you might do is actually remove those servers from the plugin XML temporarily and rely on one of the other parameters to refresh the plugin so that those app servers are not actually in the cluster. Another trick we've seen is that you could specify the clone ID to be 0 and a weight of 0 for those servers that are been temporarily taken out of the cluster. That's primarily important in a case where you power off the app server. There may be other situations as well, but what you're trying to avoid is the case where the plugin makes a connection or tries to make a connection to the app server and doesn't get an immediate reset back from the system. In that case, That's when the plug-in timeout comes into play. A powered-off machine would cause that. Slide 26, please. Server I/O timeout. This is probably one of the main timers that affects the plug-in and response time. This is how long the plug-in will wait for a response from the app server. So when we send a GET request or a POST request to the app server, plug-in goes into a wait, waiting on that response. At that point, that's when the server I/O timeout starts. You need to specify a value that will be able to handle the longest running request that goes through the system. So even though you might have 90% of your requests happening in 5 seconds, if you've got several long running ones that take 65 seconds, 70 seconds to run, then the server I/O timeout has to be long enough to handle that. The value of zero means there's no timeout. We strongly advise against using this. The only time I might suggest trying to use a value of zero would be if you're trying to figure out what your request timing values are. In that particular case, you might run for a little bit with a value of zero. Within the IHS access log, you could specify percent uppercase T, add that to your log format, and then check the timings in the access log. The percent uppercase T gives you the response time in seconds. That's an easy way of checking how long your requests are running. You would then check your access log to see what is your normal case and then set the server I/O timeout based off of that. If you have a large cluster with many members, retries can be detrimental as a result of large server I/O timeout values. The plugin retries requests when you hit a server I/O timeout. So if you've got 12 members of a cluster, you could potentially go through quite a few servers trying to handle a request, especially if your back-end problem happens to be something like a common database and the length of the response is due to a backup in a database, in which case you keep retrying that request across multiple app servers. A negative number for the server I/O timeout will cause the plugin to mark the app server down. A positive number will just time it out and then retry on the next server. Slide 27, please. There's also now a parameter called server I/O timeout retry. This can be used to limit how often the plugin will retry a request when you're dealing with large clusters. A value of 0 or minus 1, or a value of minus 1 will basically say there's no limit. And in that particular case, the maximum number of retries that can occur is the number of members in the cluster plus 1. The plus 1 is due to the fact that the plugin on a existing connection will close that connection and retry on a new one first. 0 means don't do any retries. You just fail immediately after the request timed out. Or you can specify a number N that's less than the number in the cluster. So for a 12-member cluster, you might tell it to retry twice. Here again, performance implication would be if you're telling it to retry a large number of times and it's a large server I/O timeout, you can end up with very large response times to end up getting a 500 internal server error. Slide 28, please. refresh interval. This Naveen already alluded to. This is how often the plugin checks for a change in the plugin cfg.xml file. The plugin basically stats the XML file to see if it's changed. When the plugin's doing the stat, it's being done under the child process, so you need to make sure that that child process has the ability to do the stat, so it needs to have the proper permissions. If you have issues where you see the plugin not reloading, that might be the answer. One thing to keep in mind, if you frequently change the plugin XML file due to deployments or due to whatever, then you might consider changing the default value, which is 60 seconds. As Naveen mentioned, if you have a large number of processes, each one of those processes, every time the plugin changes, is going to reload the plugin. If you have a plugin that's several thousand lines long with a large number of clusters, large number of app servers, large number of transports, that's overhead that each process is going to go through every time the plugin changes. That can lead to very large response time issues that occurs at a random time, like every time you deploy an application, you might see that kind of thing spike. That would be the reasoning. In a particular case like that, you may want to set the refresh interval down, or you might do something such as change the settings in the application server so that the plugin doesn't automatically propagate or generate every time something like that's done, just to keep down how often the plugin XML file changes. Slide 29, please. The retry interval. That's how often the plugin will retry a server that's been marked down. This is basically a number that you would need to set pretty much based off of your own needs, whatever the environment is you're running in. Depends on the reasons for marking a server down. If you've got a true hung app server, you may want that server to be down for longer than 60 seconds. You may not want the plugin retrying it after 60 seconds. You may have an app server marked down intentionally because you've taken it out of rotation for some reason. Do you want it retried every so often? That's another reason where rather than having the plugin mark it down, you might actually take the server out of the plugin XML file. There again, all depends on the environment. These are just properties that can be set based off of your own needs. Just be aware of what the impact is in your particular situation. Slide 30, please. PM94198. This added three new environment variables: the WebSphere Server IO timeout, the WebSphere Server timeout retry, and the WebSphere shortened handshake. What you see in there is three different examples of how to code these new environment variables. And that coding would go in the HTTP comp file. This is only applicable to Apache or IHS. Obvious reasons is that's where these environment variables can be set and the plugin recognize them. What this gives you the ability to do is control certain parameters. The server IO timeout specifically is the one that is probably going to be the most utilized here. It gives you the ability to have a much smaller default value for server IO timeout for the 90% of your requests, and then the other requests that are long running you can make URI specific with this environment variable. So it gives you the ability to tweak the server IO timeout setting based off of a URI value. Likewise, you can tweak the server IO timeout retry, and the one that may not be intuitively obvious is the shortened handshake environment variable. That specifically addresses the SSL extended handshake property and the 100 continue. It allows you to set a timeout for those two situations so that you're not just dealing, that will actually use the connect timeout value to set a timeout for the 100 continue that comes on a post request or on a GET request if you specifically request it, and on SSL extended handshake. Slide 31, please. Connections. Here again, Naveen touched on this a little. Max connections is the parameter you can use in the plugin to limit the number of connections the plugin process will make to the application server. It's the number of pending connections allowed. A pending connection, by definition, is the plugin has made the request and has gone into a wait state waiting on the response. That's what we consider a pending connection. It's per process. The value of 0 or minus 1 means there's no limit, strictly controlled by the app server. Setting a value in N, we don't normally advise using this. As Naveen mentioned, it can be problematic. If you're dealing with a load-balanced environment where you may have 4 or 5 web servers, each of those web servers, you might be dealing with 20, 25 processes. You now have over 100 plugin processes, each with their own setting for number of connections to the app server. And it's the same app server in the back end for all of your web servers. So trying to control that connections is going to totally depend upon whether processes are going up and down. Are all of the web servers in your load balancing configuration? Have some of them been taken out? So it can get quite confusing in terms of trying to control how many connections are actually available to the app server. If you take two of your web servers out of your load balancing configuration, you've suddenly limited yourself to how many connections can go to the app server. You're usually better off trying to limit the connections at the app server itself rather than control it across the multiple plugin processes within the multiple web servers. Slide 32. Persistent connections. This is where you will get a big payoff from a performance viewpoint. It's set at the application server, and it's set from the web container transport chain. That's the value where you see your keep alive connections and the keep alive timeout, persistent timeout settings for your HTTP or HTTPS transport. What that'll do is it'll establish a connection pool that the plugin then reuses, and the plugin will try to reuse a request as frequently as it can. In the plugin case, it doesn't matter whether it's coming from the same client or not. We will keep reusing connections if they're open. So you get a big payoff by having the persistent connections there. This is especially true for the SSL because you'd be avoiding your SSL handshakes for the most part. We introduced a new parameter called property called connection TTL. This started fairly recent at 7.0.0.29, the 8.0.0.6, and 8.5.0.2 level. this is a timeout within the plugin for persistent connections. Prior to this time, the timeout would occur within the app server itself at whatever value the application server sets, 30 seconds being the default. The danger we had with that is that there are certain cases where the plugin could be trying to send a request to the application server at the exact time the application server is trying to time out a persistent connection. There are very rare cases where you could end up with the app server trying to close the connection on something like an SSL connection, where we're getting an alert from SSL saying the connection closed, but at the same time, there was a race condition on the app server that allowed that request to actually go through while it was closing it. The plugin resends the request, and you can end up having two posts for the same transaction occurring within microseconds of each other. To get around that situation, the connection TTL was created so that the plugin would close an idle connection prior to the application server closing it. The default value, as you can see there, will be 28 seconds, which is 2 seconds prior to the app server. What this may do is cause you to see more timeouts in the app server side that are due the plugin actually closing the connection before the app server does. Slide 33, please. The impact of having multiprocessing. Like the web server, each process within the plugin has its own set of counters, its separate child. They don't know about each other. So you have a separate cache for each process. So you have memory associated with that cache, the fact that the cache is not shared. The separate counters. One process does not know that the other process has marked app server down, so it has to reinvent the wheel when finding out that an app server is actually down. An advantage of multiprocessing is if you have a crash, you're only affecting that one process. A disadvantage, more complicated load balancing is involved because each one has their own set of counters for maintaining the load balancing. It all comes down to trade-offs in web server performance reliability versus the fact that you've got multiple counters and have to keep track of different things for each process. Somewhere there's a happy medium, and that's going to vary from site to site depending on what's being done in that particular environment. Slide 34. This is another area that we see fairly frequently. Someone comes in saying, there's an imbalance in the application servers and load balancing. The thing to realize is that the plugin load balances based off of new connections. It's got two algorithms. One is random, the other being round robin. Random is usually best when you're dealing with multiple members within a cluster. More than two. If you've got a small number, 2, 3, round robin is usually sufficient. You can use log level stats to check out the load balancing, and you'll see that stats will tell you how many affinity requests there are, how many total requests, and how many new requests. The load balancing is done based off of new requests. The thing that confuses people or causes imbalances is the fact that the plugin does not know the difference in new requests being a new session create versus something like a JPEG. So you can end up where the plugin is load balanced 4 requests, 3 of them are JPEGs, one of them's a request for a login. That login causes a new session to get created, and now you have affinity being set to that specific app server. All subsequent requests with that J session ID or whatever session ID is used will go to that app server. That's where the imbalance comes in, is the fact that the plugin, when the next new request that comes in, is not going to know that one is a new session request or a JPEG. So you may not get it spread out quite evenly in terms of sessions. New requests will be spread out, but not necessarily new sessions. Slide 35. Log level at trace. This is very expensive. The plugin under load can generate several gig of trace data in a very small amount of time. You should typically not use log level trace except when debugging to find out specific problems. Ideally, when you use log level trace, you would want to have a recreatable scenario where you can recreate the situation and then get out. The advantage of having the refresh interval within the plugin is that you can set this parameter dynamically, and within 60 seconds, it takes effect. Then you can turn it off dynamically by resetting it back to error. Post buffer size. This can be important in terms of, this is the amount of size that's used for a post. So if you have post data, we'll buffer that based off of the post buffer size setting. That allows you to retry post request if there's a failure. If you set a value of zero, that request cannot be retried. Some sites will set it to zero intentionally just to make sure post requests are never retried as a way of avoiding duplicate transactions. Slide 36. That concludes the plugin portion. These are some references that you can use. The first reference there is the IHS Diag. I cannot stress how important this URL is. The IHS Diag is something that's maintained by our development team. It's pretty much dynamic documentation that's going to get updated much more frequently than you would the Knowledge Center. We have a facts section out there. Our must gather is out there. There's a performance section out there. There's all kinds of useful information that you will find there. If you check there before calling into support, oftentimes you can find answers without ever having to call us. The last reference is the Knowledge Center. Next slide, and I believe this may be where you take back over, Kathy.
Yes, I do. Thank you very much, Naveen and Marvin, for a great presentation. Excuse me. At this point, I'd like to open up the lines for question and answer.
Our first question comes from David Yu. Your line is open.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I have a question about, I have two questions. During the presentation, you mentioned about cryptographic accelerator only improved 10% of the performance. And we are running IHS and the WAS on ZOS. And does it apply to, is this 10% applied to the our environment? The second question is, we have the FI running as a client, and also we have IHS and WAS. Which component decide which cipher stack to be used? And then the next question is, if we are using the cipher between the FI to IHS. Can we remove the SSL requirement between the plugin to the WASP? Thank you.
From the cipher perspective, you've got multiple handshakes that will be going on there. You've got the handshake going to F5. Then you have a handshake from F5 to the web server or web servers. And then you have the plug-in to the app server. Each one of those has their own separate ciphers. And depending on what ciphers are specified at each point, determines what ciphers are used. The F5 settings, I couldn't tell you what those are. That would be more a question for Cisco. But I would assume it would be something similar to us where they can specify the required ciphers for coming in, and then you would have to meet those requirements. Then you're going to have the handshake that occurs from them going to IHS, and then IHS cipher is going to be based off of the SSL cipher spec directives, as Naveen mentioned. And then there's another handshake occurring from the plug-in to the app server. Now, you can have SSL offloading at any point in this process. We often see the SSL offloading occurring at the F5. That's where the HTTPS indicator header comes into play, where you specify that at the F5, set a header within the F5, that header gets passed to the app server, and it then knows SSL is actually used. Now, whether this is a viable thing that can be done is going to depend upon audit points, the environment. Is everything behind the DMZ after the F5? Do you consider that secure enough? These are all questions that the client has to answer. If you're dealing with a situation where everything is self-contained, then the offloading is quite frequently done at the F5. Whether the app server requires that or not, that's up to the coding there and the security settings. But we also see it where they do the SSL offloading and port 80 is accepted by the app server. The 10%, Naveen, can you speak to that on the accelerator card?
Yeah, so what I was trying to say here is that there is a 10, statistically we have seen that there's about a 10% improvement in performance using a crypto hardware option of SSL encryption. Keeping in mind that configuring and maintaining a cryptographic card and using a hardware cryptography option is complicated, one has to decide if the advantage gained merits that over a soft solution of SSL handshake using a third-party certificating authority. So that's what I was trying to allude to. It's a choice which every client has to make for themselves. Obviously, there is an advantage using hardware cryptography option, but one has to decide whether it's worth the additional heartache and headache.
There was one that came in since we started the Q&A. Can you please tell me more about three-way handshake process?
Three-way handshake. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by the three-way. They may be referring to the mutual authentication. Mutual authentication being where the client provides a certificate as well as the target. For instance, you could have mutual authentication coming into IHS where the web server presents its certificate and then the client in turn presents its certificate back to IHS. Both sides have to trust each other. It's additional security that has to be done. Your client has to have a certificate. This is something where you might see websites that have specific clients that are required to have certificates to use their software. You might also see this in a case where you have a server-to-server handshake and you want to verify that each server is who they say they are. It's added level of security. It is additional overhead, though.
Naveen, there has been quite a lot in the web conference questions that have been asked there. Is there anything in there to recap or anything that questions you might want to address here?
So Doug had a question. If he's using proxy, WebSeal proxy.
So it could all use one cipher spec.
Right, right.
The single cipher spec, once you hit the initial proxy server, whether it's WebSeal or some other proxy, from that point on, you could probably have everything set up to use a single cipher because you're in a static environment where you're going server to server to server to server. Whereas the client, you may have a wider variety of what ciphers can be utilized depending on the clients coming in. So the wider usage of ciphers would be your very front end where the client first hits. I believe that's what he was trying to get at.
Correct. You're right.
There was another question. It says FRCA is Windows only. I assume that's French-Canadian is Windows only. Is that correct?
Yeah, FRCA, Fast Accelerator, is Windows-specific.
What are the performance implications of enabling mod status or mod MPM stats?
That would be totally dependent upon the type of interval set. Within the mod MPM stats, you can specify intervals as to how often statistics are recorded. So there'll be some minor overhead for keeping track of statistics, and then you would have the overhead of writing them out to the log. So if you're frequently doing it, say, every 5 seconds, there's going to be a much larger impact than doing it every 5 minutes. So a lot of it depends upon the interval. For the most part, it's not something that's a major concern. I would only be concerned if you were trying to record it extremely frequent.
The next question I see here is, does this presentation apply to ZOS?
No, it does not. IHS on ZOS is a different beast.
So the suggestion is to have RC4 first. Is that the default?
The suggestion is to have the lowest level cipher first to avoid the overhead of the largest cipher. That's totally dependent upon the environment and in terms of security that's required there. Lately, I've seen multiple scanners coming in where they do not even allow 128-bit encryption. And in those particular cases, you have to utilize 168 as your first cipher. So this is really going to depend upon what level of security, what kind of scan software you're running. Some scan softwares will not allow, say, CVC ciphers. It really is going to depend upon the environment. The main thing is with IHS, you can set the order you want by using the SSL cipher spec directive and make it whichever way you want it to be. So if you're only allowing AES, you can specify AES only. If you don't allow 128, you can start with 168 and then a 256. It's really dependent upon the environment.
Also, in later versions of IHS, we discourage using older, weaker cipher specs.
Yeah, most scanners will not allow a weaker cipher.
The next one is SSL logging would be used to determine what gets used the most in your environment. So should you place that one first in your file?
You could place SSL-specific logging within the virtual host configuration for the transport specified for, you know, the SSL traffic. That would be the place to place your SSL logging directives.
And then next one, question came in from Reddy. Can we know currently how many users are connected?
So, yeah, you can use SiteMinder to, get formatted output for the number of users using the website. You can use Max Connections, but that's not the real intended use or value of that setting.
I don't see anything else that's new in there. So at this time, we will be closing the presentation. Thank you, Naveen and Marvin, for presenting today. Have a great day.